Good morning. I'd like to thank Bill Campbell and John Wilson for the honor of being part of this session. Indeed, it's a great privilege to be on the panel with Mark and Leonard and Steve, and after that, these presentations, I'm most humble. Sitting at the edge of the platform reminds me of the first American Economic Association meeting that I attended in 1974. I was there to see Jim Buchanan and perform, and Lester Thoreau happened to be presenting a paper at the same panel. When Lester Thoreau finished his paper, he was sitting at the edge of the podium, just as I am, and Lester put down his papers and walked over, promptly fell off the edge of the platform. And of course, the travesty was that he got up and continued to talk after that. It didn't bother him. So, at any rate, my presentation on the Chicago School goes beyond economics and touches upon the role of sociology and strong personality in shaping what we perceive as the Chicago School. For my presentation, I will focus on what I consider some of the lesser-known sides of the Chicago School. But first, let me reveal my biases. In 1987, I was co-founder of the Henry Simon Society, and I continue to be the secretary of this group. We've had over 50 dinner discussion meetings, and we've had papers, a number of papers on Henry Simons, most notably presented by Alan Wallace, Herb Stein, and Jim Buchanan. I was fortunate to know Alan Wallace and to have access to some of his papers and also his insights on the Chicago School. I'm also a student of Jim Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, and these people made major contributions to the Virginia School of Political Economy, which I consider one of the primary spores or viruses of the Chicago School. I've also been privileged to know Ronald Coase through my work on an intellectual biography of Duncan Black, who with Coase received his first academic appointment in 1931, and they have remained friends ever since. My research in this area has several messages, although not derivable from what I'm going to say today. First, it shows that once again, that the battle for ideas is often fought under different guises: methodology, politics, personality. But in the end, the good ideas endure, and the bad ones are discarded, although not quickly enough, and often at great personal sacrifice. Second, it shows that academicians often view the value of their ideas as self-evident, but it often takes interpreters and forums and a cheering section to promote and flesh out their ideas and make use of them. And this is the role of the Philadelphia Society. It has served it well, and I'm sure it will continue to do so. The Chicago School is generally associated with the ideas of monetarism, Adam Smith's invisible hand postulate, both for individual behavior and in the evolution of institutions. It's associated with opposition to government intervention in general, and Keynesianism in particular. And as a later development, it has been associated with the economic analysis of the law. Well, my presentation seeks to draw a distinction between two meanings of the idea of a Chicago School of Economics. First, as an economic methodology, and second, as a set of policy prescriptions. The methodology, famously articulated by Milton Friedman in his essay on positive economics in 1953, has for decades been the dominant paradigm within the economics profession. The set of policy prescriptions associated with the work of economists from the University of Chicago emphasize a limited role for government within a flourishing market order. Second, they emphasize a belief in the efficacy of free markets to allocate resources and distribute income. And finally, a belief in the power of neoclassical price theory to explain observed economic behavior. Now, the roots of the Chicago School are found in the interaction among the faculty and the students who first met at the University of Chicago in the 1930s. The Chicago School is associated with J. Lawrence Laughlin, Jacob Viner, Frank H. Knight, Henry C. Simons, and Aaron Director, whom I'm sure you know is the brother of Rose Friedman. Laughlin is less well known, and most people would not include him in this group. But I think we should begin with him for several reasons. First, Laughlin's most important and lasting contribution was as head of the Department of Political Economy at the new University of Chicago, generously endowed by none other than the Rockefeller family, as a non-sectarian university with an emphasis on research. Though known as a rigid opponent of the quantity theory of money, Laughlin demonstrated an extraordinary degree of tolerance for divergent views in staffing and in guiding the young department. For example, he was responsible for hiring Jacob Viner and hiring Thorsten Veblen. Both Viner and Veblen served as editors of the, or as the editor of the Journal of Political Economy, with Veblen being the first editor. Laughlin's emphasis in faculty appointments was very important in setting up the tone and tenor of the new department. First, he looked for quality rather than ideology. And second, he stressed the importance of research by his faculty as part of their job and by graduate students as part of their training. He believed in personal teaching as opposed to formal lecturing, and he emphasized that economics was a serious scientific subject capable of being tested empirically and by historical evidence. In one form or another, this characterization has remained descriptive of the Chicago School. As an aside, Laughlin also held strong views of which he was not reluctant to voice. One example was Laughlin's refusal in the mid-1920s to join the American Economic Association because he viewed it as merely a bunch of socialists. He was probably correct. But then again, so were many of the students and the faculty at the University of Chicago. In the early 30s, Alan Wallace describes the students as Norman Thomas socialists who were avid readers of the New Republic and the Nation. Now, Simons, Knight, and Viner are the more familiar names that are associated with the early years of the Chicago School. Later during the 50s and 60s, the Chicago School became widely known for the work of Milton Friedman in monetary economics and, of course, George Stigler in industrial organization and regulation. The law and economics movement developed in the 1960s with seminal work of Ronald Coase, an Aaron director, and their editorship of the Journal of Law and Economics. There were other precursors to this, but these were the foremost promoters of that type of research. Law and economics have, of course, been extended by a number of economists with an interest in the law, most notably Gary Becker. Building on the pioneering work at Chicago were distinguished contributions from economists at other universities who had either graduated from Chicago or taught there for some period. An appropriate metaphor to describe these people might be spores or even viruses. These spores of the Chicago School were characterized by a deep and abiding respect for its intellectual traditions. They include Armin Alshin and Harold Demsitz at UCLA for their work in the economics of property rights, James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock as founders of the Virginia School of Political Economy, which includes constitutional political economy and public choice. A more remote connection to the Chicago School is the new institutional school associated with Douglas North, formerly at the University of Washington at Seattle and now at Washington University at St. Louis. He employs the insights of Coase and Alshin and Demsitz on property rights, and as an aside, North was a student of Frank Knight's brother, M.M. Knight, when Douglas North was at Berkeley. He also worked at the NBER, or National Bureau of Economic Research, which is a characteristic shared by Stigler, Becker, and Friedman, as well as Alan Wallace. And the founders are easily dividable into a number of characteristics which I think are useful. Among the founders, we might distinguish those with a mission or a crusade, those with a passion or a mania, and those with a system. The style and contributions of some of the founders and their successors fits more than one category, however. Simons had a mission. As expressed in a positive program for laissez-faire, some proposals for a liberal economic policy, which was a pamphlet that he published in 1934. It was most unlike what we associate with Chicago today, but it was influential in shaping the inquiry and the ideas that became associated with the Chicago School. Simons was a strong advocate for political freedom and equality, which he thought could only be obtained by a progressive income tax structure and restraints on private markets, characteristics and policies most atypical of the Chicago School. Simons believed that the world of the 1930s was facing a crisis of historic magnitude, and that the survival of both freedom and the economic viability of the Western world was at stake. Simons believed passionately, and it was his message to inform about this, that the crisis of the 1930s had to be handled well, or the basic values of civilization would be lost, and he dedicated his life to that task. As many of you know, he committed suicide in 1946, fearing that he suffered stomach cancer. On the other hand, Knight was believed that the crisis was grave, but he believed that somehow we would muddle through it and Western civilization would survive. In a similar vein, Milton Friedman and George Stigler had a mission to empirically test economic theories. Knight, on the other hand, had a passion for puzzles as the basis for scientific inquiry. Both Knight and Simons emphasized the need to be critical in evaluating scientific work, and that the age or high office of the researcher was not to be considered in evaluating their research. Their style, the style of Knight and Simons, shaped the inquiry to leave no stone unturned and to consider no doctrine sacrosanct, no matter who its originator. Knight's refusal to accept anything uncritically made him the source of endless ideas for students to discuss and to do research on. Although the members of the Chicago School at this point had similar leanings toward key elements of economics and policies, their personal styles differed greatly, and some had cheering sections and groups of students that promoted their ideas, and others didn't. One of the ones who did not was Aaron Director. Director was born in 1899 and still lives. He has a very interesting history, which I would like to go into, but it would take quite a while for his life story, as he started as a labor activist in the 20s. Although Director had the type of personality which made him less likely to have a following, he is considered by many to be the tradition behind the Chicago tradition. Although sharing fewer characteristics with the others in the Chicago School, Jacob Viner, the systematizer, may be credited with the emphasis of the Chicago School on microeconomics and his view of the economy as a complex system which could be modeled. Building upon the microeconomic theory was Milton Friedman with his classic but little known book on price theory, which was assembled from notes by two students, one of whom is in the group today, David Fand. According to several of his students, Viner had a somewhat overbearing personal style, which explained his lack of acolytes. Knight, on the other hand, was popular with students, and Henry Simons was a leading light among the undergraduates. Another factor that contributed to the success of the Chicago School in developing its ideas and in fleshing them out was that the intellectual atmosphere was very conducive to interchange among faculty and students. According to Alan Wallace, who had a key but lesser known influence on the Chicago School, the intellectual atmosphere at Chicago was much different than you would find at other graduate schools both then and today. According to Wallace, the graduate students were treated as if they were colleagues, and the faculty would act as if they thought they were going to get a good idea from you. The good ones came often, and discussion and debate never ceased. So that characterized that period, which was so formative in the development of the Chicago School. I'd like to relate a story about Gordon Tullock, although it's out of sequence, but it does show the role of the students and the early roots of what came to be associated with Chicago. The law faculty at Chicago included Walter J. Blum and Harry Calvin, who wrote The Uneasy Case for Progressive Taxation, somewhat in response, but much later than Henry Simon. After the war, Gordon Tullock took their courses in income taxation and bankruptcy at the law school at Chicago. It's also worthy to note that Gordon Tullock had one course in economics in his career, which he said was more than enough, and that was from Henry Simons, and he didn't finish that because he was drafted into the Army after only 10 weeks of that semester. Tullock related this story. One day, during a class discussion, the question had arisen as to the origin of the graduated income tax. Tullock had spoken up in class, not unlike Tullock would. that if the objective is equality, as stated by Henry Simon, one would merely set a desired income level and then tax everything above it and pay it to everyone who had less than that, and maintain equality that way. Unlike most everything that Tulloch said, and this was surprising to Tulloch, this did not evoke much of a response from either Blum or Calvin. Little was said that day, but the next day, Blum and Calvin indicated that their view that it would indicated their view that it would not work, that taxing one and giving to the other in this way would have a very detrimental effect to the incentive to work, which of course is a fundamental Chicago insight. That afternoon, however, Tulloch was in the men's washroom and happened to mention to another student that his view that the reason we have the progressive income tax is that there are more voters in the lower income tax brackets than there are voters in the upper income tax bracket. At that point, Calvin emerged from one of the booths looking triumphant, failed to acknowledge Tulloch, and walked briskly out of the men's room. The following day, Calvin asked if anyone believed the reason for graduated taxes was that there were more voters in the lower income tax brackets. Of course, Tulloch raised his hand, but he was ignored. Afterwards, Tulloch asked why they had ignored him. Blum's response was that he and Calvin both were simply afraid of Tulloch. Well, Tulloch did not consider this unusual, but I think it's quite typical of the kind of students that were attracted to Chicago, as well as the type of interchange that took place, although not all in the men's room. Now, Friedman, of course, is known for his work on the consumption function and the quantity theory of money. But he was really a seminal influence on the Chicago School in terms of his work on price theory. Friedman took price theory very seriously, and as a consequence, he got his students to think about the formal results of theory, to apply theory to understand the world, and then to generate a hypothesis that they would then go out and test. Well, all of this was well and good. In the late 1930s, an organization named the Coles Foundation, or Coles Commission, was started by Alfred Coles to empirically test, or to begin to empirically test financial information. The Coles people located at the University of Chicago, they were the more abstract element of the faculty. And the other group, which you could say would be the NBER types, which are like data gatherers, began to have tiffs between the Coles Foundation people and over faculty appointments and methodology and this thing and another. From the Coles Foundation did emerge the Journal of Econometrica is their flagship. And they are, of course, involved in much more theoretical endeavors than the NBER people were. Now, this fight took place over faculty appointments, and it was ultimately resolved with the appointment of Alan Wallace in the business school, Milton Friedman in economics, and George Stigler. Now, once all of this was resolved, then the Chicago School could kind of get down and do the things that we now see associated with it. So the law and economics movement, of course, came later in the 60s, and had a major impact on how we view the law, as well as how we view most every other facet of life. Let me close with some observations, however. There's no Chicago. Chicago that came from this era is not around. It's not there anymore. It's gone on. The evolution of intellectual traditions and personalities associated with Chicago through Friedman, Stigler, and Becker remains important, however. And these people drove the school with their very overwhelming intellect and the energy with which they attacked their discipline. Those infected with Chicago went forward and they planted those seeds of the tradition. But many would argue that it's simply much different today. The idea of a large number of graduate students moving through the university, assuming positions in government or in academia, is just not the case. Furthermore, some would argue that Friedman's positivist methodology continues to dominate, but shows signs of slipping. While people like Becker, Sherwin Rosen, and Bob Lucas remain at Chicago, There is no generation imbued with the Chicago traditions to succeed them. However, regardless of the location, the insights of the Chicago School will continue to affect policy. And I think that's a great contribution of the school.